The last case on our calendar is 96-2706, In re Patrick Washington. Ms. Ostrey.
May it please the court, my name is Randy Ostrey. I, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Patrick McCarthy, represent the appellant, the state of Ohio, in this action. At this time, the state wishes to request 4 minutes for rebuttal. The central issue to be decided today is, should this court reverse the appellate court's judgment, which vacated Appellee's adjudication of delinquency on the charge of aggravated murder, because the Court of Appeals usurped its appellate reviewing authority and applied the wrong standard to a sufficiency claim. Specifically, the majority, while cloaking their reasoning of reversal on insufficient evidence, substituted its judgment for that of the trier of fact and essentially acted as a 13th juror, something that is forbidden in reviewing sufficiency claims. The facts in this case are briefly as follows. Earlier in the day, on January 3rd, 1995, Patrick Washington, along with his brother Brian, and
we've gone over the facts. Would you hone in on what facts that you saw in the record that supported the fact that they were going to take a loaded gun versus an unloaded? Because there's testimony in the record that they're supposed to take an unloaded gun, but then there's evidence of firing a gun on the porch before. What facts support the loaded gun in the cab?
Well, first, earlier in the day, there were four rehearsals that took place. During those rehearsals, the gun was being loaded and unloaded and being pointed at different people during the rehearsal. Second, and perhaps most significantly, on the front porch, as the group was waiting for the taxicab to come, the appellee directed Leland Watkins, the holder of the sawed-off shotgun, to give that shotgun to Antonio Robinson, where Robinson was directed to shoot out windows of a parked vehicle. So therefore, the gun was loaded. There was a spent casing that was found at the scene, even proving that. And third, the fact that the gun was loaded was the victim was killed. But most importantly, regarding a reviewing of this type, is that it is irrelevant, legally irrelevant, whether the gun was loaded or not. Because a loaded gun or an unloaded gun, either scenario, it is still a dangerous instrumentality. According to the legislature, in Revised Code 29-2311K1, it defines what a dangerous instrumentality is, and that is any sawed-off firearm. It doesn't say a loaded sawed-off firearm, or it doesn't say an unloaded. It says any sawed-off firearm. Secondly, not only did the legislature speak on this, but this court spoke on this in State versus Clark, wherein this court upheld the conviction of an aggravated murder of a victim who was bludgeoned to death by a sawed-off shotgun. So therefore, it was irrelevant whether there were bullets, whether there were shells in the shotgun or not. So clearly, it's a dangerous instrumentality. Specifically, the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals hung their hat on the fact that the testimony indicated it was unloaded. First of all, the testimony did not indicate that entirely. There was some conflicting testimony. But secondly, it's legally irrelevant whether it was or not. And therein lies the problem. The state was required to prove in this instance, as stated first in State versus Lockett and reaffirmed in State versus Scott, that we had the burden of showing that the participants entered into a common scheme or design to commit a felony. That we showed, and in fact that was even conceded by the majority, that we presented sufficient evidence. Specifically at pages 23 and 24 of the majority opinion, it stated that the state presented sufficient evidence to show that the appellant, which was Patrick Washington below, entered into a common design with the other participants to commit a felony. The next sentence in that opinion says, the state presented evidence that during the commission of the felony, Ronald LaShore was killed. Now, we showed far more than that. We showed from the facts and circumstances.
But counsel, your issue here is about the standard of review, that there was a misapplication by the Court of Appeals of the standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence?
Yes.
Tell us, what is that? What is the finding right there, a finding of sufficiency? Is that your point? They made a finding that there was sufficient evidence?
No, what the Court of Appeals did was ignore the evidence that was presented and in ignoring the evidence, they substituted their judgment for that of the trier of fact. They weren't permitted to do that. Under a manifest weight standard, they can get into the facts and decide what they're going to believe and what they're not going to believe.
But this, of course, they couldn't. This wasn't a manifest weight.
Correct.
Case because it's not unanimous, among other things, right? It has
well,
to be unanimous.
Yes, but in bench trials, it does not this need to be unanimous.
Trial, sure. What is the proper standard of review for the Court of Appeals for sufficiency?
It is, first of all, the Court of Appeals must test the evidence or examine the evidence, as stated by State versus Jenks and reaffirmed in State versus Tompkins, to examine the evidence admitted on questions of law only, to determine whether such evidence, if believed by the trier of fact, would convince the average mind of the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The relevant inquiry then is whether after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, which also was not done here.
That's the distinguishing factor. There is no weighing of evidence in a sufficiency consideration.
Correct. There is no weighing and there isn't any factual determinations. This court was very clear in State versus Tompkins that a sufficiency claim is only on questions of law. And clearly, in this case, the state presented adequate evidence. That's what was needed. It is a test of adequacy.
And if it's a sufficiency test, then it's mandatory, is it not? A court finding a lack of sufficiency or not sufficient evidence must discharge.
Yes, if they find that it's sufficient, okay. if it was insufficient evidence.
The reason I ask is because the Court of Appeals opinion, in part, says that the charge for aggravated murder pursuant to 290301 is reversed and vacated. Now, where does this case stand? Obviously, they remand it back to the lower court, they say, for sentencing. Is it just sentencing on the other charge?
Yes, on the aggravated robbery charge. But a reversal on an insufficiency requires a reversal and a vacation because it's a due process violation.
Well, you have to vacate, but usually what we do is say and the defendant is discharged or acquitted on something of that. Vacated simply means you could start over, doesn't it?
No, this court held in State versus Tompkins that the state cannot retry because double jeopardy already attaches.
I understand. And that's always true with a sufficiency argument, isn't it?
With a sufficiency argument,
okay.
Correct. But the problem becomes is what the state needed to prove and did prove was we brought forward adequate evidence on each element of the crime that, if believed, would convince the average mind, not would convince the Court of Appeals. The law is clear that it is the trier of fact that needs to be convinced, not the Court of Appeals that needs to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And clearly, the majority opinion stated that they drew the largest leap, which was fatal to the prosecution, when they stated, at page 28 of the opinion, the only testimony that indicated that the participants planned to use a gun also indicated that the gun was to be unloaded. While we take issue with that factually, that's not dispositive of the issue here. The Court of Appeals goes on to state in the next sentence, thus, which means drawing an inference from that first sentence, thus the state failed to show that Patrick Washington knew that an inherently dangerous instrumentality, and in parentheses, a loaded gun, was to be employed in the robbery, or to show that the manner of the accomplishment would be reasonably likely to result in death. Now, it's clear that this was a dangerous instrumentality, so the majority reasoning is flawed and fatal to its conclusion.
Doesn't a Court of Appeals rule on both law and fact?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
Then what is wrong with the Court of Appeals on the law finding that there's not sufficient evidence?
Because there was sufficient evidence, they clearly misapplied the law.
They thought there wasn't.
But that's not for the Court of Appeals to determine. They are limited in what they can review and what they can determine. And what they did was make a clear error of law, and which they couldn't do. Now, if they would have found sufficient evidence and reached the manifest weight argument, perhaps the state would be in more trouble right now regarding that argument, because the manifest weight standard could allow them to weigh the evidence, look at the credibility, but in this instance, they are forbidden from doing that on a sufficiency claim. They clearly misapplied the law. They were hanging their hat on the fact that this was an unloaded gun, and that's That's not what we needed to prove. Our case is on all fours with the decisions and...
Okay, in this case, that may be true, but I thought you gave me a general answer that a court of appeals, or even this court, cannot determine a sufficiency argument, and certainly you can.
Yes, they can determine a sufficiency argument. What they can do is look to the law, look to the elements, and essentially plug in the facts, what the facts were below. As Justice Cook stated in State versus Tompkins in the concurrence, on review for sufficiency, courts are to assess not whether the state's evidence is to be believed, but whether, if believed, the evidence against a defendant would support a conviction. In this case, the evidence against the defendant would most certainly support a conviction. Here we have a group of criminals. They are planning to rob a cab 4 different times. Patrick Washington was actually the ringleader of this. He orchestrated the rehearsals. He knew that weapons were to be present. And in fact, he was the one who telephoned for the taxi cab that Mr. Ronald LaShore was sent to the scene. He actually led Mr. LaShore to his death. At the scene, on the porch, prior to the arrival of the taxi cab, there was a sawed-off shotgun there, the one that was the murder weapon. Clearly, that's a dangerous instrumentality, and it is black-letter law, which also the Court of Appeals did not even address, is that an actor is presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences of his action.
Did they agree in this plan that they made up that the person was going to be killed?
No, Your Honor, they did not. And the testimony was such that they stated they did not intend to kill the victim. However, that doesn't matter. This court has held on numerous occasions that intent can be presumed, and also intent can never be proved by the direct testimony of a third person.
And I believe this person was not at the scene.
No, he was not at the scene, but he was an aider and abettor.
So whatever transpired after the others left, and he was still elsewhere, obviously he had no idea what was going on between the group at that time.
Well, he knew that there was going to be a robbery, so he knew that was the intention.
Granted, I agree. He knew there was going to be a robbery. The problem comes in that he knew that there were going to be a killing also.
No, Your Honor, but that doesn't matter under the law, because an actor, again, is presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences. This court has held on numerous occasions that to be the case, that he had taken steps, substantial steps, in furtherance of the underlying felony.
Was the killing discussed after they had left the defendant?
The killing was discussed amongst them, and they had actually dispersed from the scene.
After they left this defendant?
After they left the defendant on the porch?
There's a group that goes and the defendant stays, I believe, isn't that the fact?
Yes, what had happened was Mr. LaShore had seen trouble coming and divided the group in two. And Patrick Washington was one of the ones who was left behind.
Okay. All I want to know is, did they discuss this killing after they had left the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the record suggests on the porch. I guess I'm not sure.
Out of his presence, though, wasn't it?
Yes, but still, once Mr. LaShore was killed.
Pardon?
Once Mr. LaShore was killed, did they discuss it?
No. After they left the defendant. The defendant wasn't present when the robbery took place. Actually present, was he?
No. During the killing, no.
Right. So obviously, those who participated had to leave him at some time. Correct?
Right.
And all I want to know is, was after they left him, did they then discuss what was going to be done with the person they want to rob?
No.
Okay.
I thought they testified, didn't they, that they didn't intend to kill him?
Yes, but...
Accidental or... Isn't that true?
Yes, they didn't. They testified to that, but that really doesn't matter legally.
No, I mean, Justice Sweeney's question was there... Did they talk about killing the cab driver after they left the defendant, which would indicate that he didn't know this was something that they had cooked up after they left the defendant? But that's their testimony was, I thought their testimony was, that they never intended to kill the cab driver. Is that correct, or did I read that wrong?
Well, they did testify that they didn't intend to kill, but certainly those were self-serving statements. They wouldn't implicate themselves
sure,
on the stand.
I'm not suggesting that they should have said something different. I'm just trying to piece it together.
But even so, as this court held in State versus Clark, that an actor, even though he doesn't intend to kill, is bound by the consequences naturally resulting from the commission of one of the enumerated felonies. I see that I'm out of time. My co-counsel will be taking rebuttal, and he was trial counsel, so perhaps he could answer factually. For these reasons, the state of Ohio respectfully requests this court to reverse the judgment of reversal from the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Ms. Ostry. Mr. Arby. Ms. Arby, I'm having it. Excuse me.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Valerie Arby of the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office. I represent the appellee, Patrick Washington, in this case. The 8th District Court of Appeals properly reversed the adjudication in this case. The case was properly decided using the standard of review set forth in State versus Jenks and Bridgman, in which the evidence was looked at in the light most favorable to the state, and the Court of Appeals determined that the state failed to meet its burden of proving the element of intent. Specifically, what the Court of Appeals did was not anything improper. There was no stepping on toes of the trial court. The Court of Appeals applied this court's holding in State versus Gooden, in which he stated that neither a trial court nor an appellate court may abdicate their responsibility to vacate a conviction or enter a judgment of acquittal when the evidence is insufficient to sustain a conviction. That is exactly what the Court of Appeals did here. They applied the right standard of law. They did what they were required and ordered to do by this court. What the state of Ohio fails to note in its argument is that one of the elements of Revised Code Section 2903.01 was not met. That statute requires the state to prove that the defendant possessed the intent to kill and cause the death of another. What that subsection D of that statute specifically notes that a conclusive inference to cause the death of another may not be had by the fact finder simply because the actor is involved in the commission of one of the felonies noted in 2903.01B, in which aggravated robbery is part of it. What the Ohio legislature did in 1981 was they specifically added that provision. What the trial court did was stated at the close of evidence and prior to disposition, we can infer your intent through different actions that took place, different evidence, different things that were said. From the evidence presented, we can infer that you had the intent to murder. He stated that to Patrick Washington. What the evidence showed was that Patrick Washington and the other young men, while disturbing, they did sit down and plan to commit an aggravated robbery of a cab driver. However, that's all the evidence showed. They showed intent to commit a robbery. State of Ohio wants to piggyback that intent to commit the robbery to the intent to commit the murder. The state relies on this court's decision in State versus Scott, in which the Court of Appeals stated, this court stated that intent can be inferred. However, the key part of Scott is that was decided in 1980. 1981 is the amendment to the statute in which we say there's no presumption, we cannot conclusively infer intent to cause the death, merely because they have participated in the aggravated robbery. We have to remember that Scott was analyzed under a different law, and the facts of Scott are distinguishable from this case. Here, Patrick Washington was not involved in the aggravated murder. The trial court improperly found him delinquent of that offense, and the Court of Appeals properly reviewed the evidence and determined that the state of Ohio failed to present evidence sufficient to meet the burden of proving intent. The state of Ohio.
Intent sufficient with respect to the person who wielded the gun?
Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
But and it's not to him because he's not present.
Because he's not present, and also in the plan that is set up in the house, the role play has Eric Fluitt, Brian Washington, and Leland Watkins going in a cab that doesn't get robbed. The second cab, which is supposed to get robbed, contains my client, Antonio Robinson, and Thurman Story. The plan that was set into motion isn't the plan that happened. What we have here is a renegade plan by Leland Watkins. He specifically intended to cause the death of Ronald LaShore. He was properly charged and properly convicted in adult court of that offense. Patrick Washington showed there's no intent shown by the state of Ohio. They're simply saying because this was offensive, this was terrible, this robbery plan, and the fact that this cab driver ended up being killed in this, that Patrick Washington must be held culpable. The state of Ohio simply failed to prove that he possessed the specific intent to kill, which they are required to do by the statute. Based on that, Your Honor, I would request that this court find that the Court of Appeals conducted a proper review of the case and that it properly reversed the decision of the juvenile court judge. I would ask that you affirm that decision.
Thank you, Ms. Arby. Mr. McCarthy, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Pat McCarthy. I represent the state of Ohio along with Randy Oshry. I was trial counsel. In Scott, this court affirmed the principle enunciated in 2903.01 D. In specific, it's the state's contention that Scott, which was decided in 1980, is embodied in 2903.01 D, because in that decision, the Supreme Court stated that the Court of Appeals was correct in affirming the Court of Appeals decision that the trial court made error in its instruction to a jury question, specifically asking about the felony murder rule, and the jury and the trial court answered that such a defendant is also guilty of aiding and abetting such murder. with respect to Scott as well,
Well, wasn't that type of case and the accomplice that got prior death penalty statute in trouble with the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. All I know is that the principle.
The statute is markedly different.
I looked at the legislative history from the Legislative Commission service, which shows that the only addition that was added to 2903.01D was Section D, which is the exact issue this Supreme Court addressed in 1980. So the state's contention that the appellee's position is incorrect. Scott is not in contradiction to the present statute. As the Court of Appeals indicated, Scott is in harmony with that division. And I'd just like to note for the record that in Scott, the defendant was not present at the time of the killing as well. Presence at the time of killing is not a necessary element of the crime. Although more than mere association is necessary, we believe we have that in this case because of the appellant's participation, not only in the rehearsing of the crime with ammunition and with loaded weapons present, and while waiting for the cab with loaded weapon present, knowing that it had just been discharged, but also that he called the cab while in possession of that information for the specific purpose so that a cab could be robbed with the weapon they just practiced with. So for those reasons, Your Honor, the state would respectfully submit that this court reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the trial court's adjudication of delinquency with respect to the aggravated murder, keeping in mind also that the Court of Appeals also ignored a presumption
Mr. McCarthy,
in a bench trial.
You've used your time.
Thank you.